A panel discussion on Friday at Western Michigan University is titled The Islamic State, Its Origins, Aims, and Capabilities. It will feature Jamshid and Carol Choksi. Both are on the faculty at Indiana University. Jamshid Choksi is also a member of the U.S. National Council of the Humanities. Carol Choksi, who joins us, he also serves as CEO of IRAD Strategic Consulting. Carol Choksi, thank you for being with us.
I'm very glad to be with you, Gordon.
So let's begin with that title. Tell us a little bit about ISIS. What are the origins of ISIS?
ISIS started as Al-Qaeda in Iraq in about 2003 with a fellow named Zarqawi, who was originally from Jordan, went to Afghanistan, and then fled in 2001 back to Iraq. He then died in 2006, and it was taken over by a fellow named al-Masri and another fellow named al-Baghdadi, who proclaimed it to be, instead of just al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Islamic State of Iraq. They then both died in 2010, and it was taken over by the present al-Baghdadi, who continued the Islamic State of Iraq, sent a lot of people into Syria in 2012 when, as it was starting up there. And he was basically trying to aid Jabhat al-Nusra, which was the al-Qaeda branch in Syria. But there was a falling out, and by April of 2013, he proclaimed that Jabhat al-Nusra was now part of the Islamic State of Iraq and that they were now the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or of the Levant, so either ISIS or ISIL, depending on how you translate the word. And, of course, Jabhat al-Nusra said, no, we're not a part of you, we're separate. In January of 2014, they pushed Jabhat al-Nusra out of Raqqa and then gradually took over all of the non-Kurdish eastern Syria. And then at that point, there had been a lot of protests by Sunnis in northern and western Iraq against the al-Maliki government. So it was very easy for him to move into Mosul and then declare in June of 2014 the Islamic State. So the history is not that long, but it's very much associated with the problems of Iraq and of Syria.
So we know that their tactics can be brutal, including beheadings, which have been filmed and distributed. Ultimately, what are they trying to do? What are the aims?
Well, they want to create their own country, and they want to reinvent the caliphate, which was either in Damascus or in Baghdad. And, of course, the caliphate wasn't necessarily one large unified country. It spread from basically just south of Constantinople all the way over into Iran and south through Egypt and all the way across northern Africa and even into Spain at one point. But it was made of little emirates, and the emirates would pledge allegiance to the caliph, but they were independent countries. So the caliph had, he could move in if he wanted to, but mostly he left people alone. But they want to reintroduce what they believe was the original form of Islam, but in the countries of the caliphate.
So perhaps most important, what are their capabilities? Do they have the ability to achieve those goals?
No, they are disciplined. They have been well supported by some of the Sunni towns and cities and tribes, though that support after the Islamic State rules for a while begins to wane because the women are sent home, they can't work. As you mentioned, the beheadings, it's quite brutal. You can be in some areas, you're beheaded for blasphemy. They include blasphemy against them, against the Islamic State, as being blasphemy against the religion. Justice is not meted out on a fair basis. And then in other areas, you know, they throw people off of buildings, they stone them. They have not been successful in making sure that the store shelves are filled. They used to have control of a lot of oil and gas. They no longer do. Their smuggling lines through Syria and Turkey have been shut down to a large part. They're not as well funded as they were.
How would you compare the current state of ISIS to, you noted that they kind of grew out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. How do they compare to Al-Qaeda, other terrorist groups, which we have come to know over the years in various forms?
Well, they're actually more like the Taliban in that they take over geographical areas and rule as a unified body. Other terrorists tend to be sort of hit and run. Even Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Islamic State of Iraq were kind of hit and run. They would work with local militias to try to get the U.S. out or the Iraqi security forces out. In Syria, they've been very different from Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the Al-Qaeda branch there, in that as soon as they went in, they wanted to take over territory, whereas Jabhat al-Nusra, their goal was to get rid of Assad and to work with other rebels to do so, and then eventually to create an Islamic State. The Islamic State and ISIS came in and simply took over the territory and started ruling it as the Islamic State.
How does ISIS recruit, and how do they pay for whatever they need to buy? I mean, what are the finances like for ISIS?
Well, they pay foreign fighters more than local fighters, and local fighters are starting to get very upset about that. They recruit through a romantic notion of returning to the founder's religion, toward a romantic notion of the Muslim conquest. But they also appeal to criminals and to people who think that violence is a solution, because obviously once you've taken over a town, then you have to rule it, and the people who are ruling it are the same people who took it over. So the other thing is that their form of religion is not necessarily what the locals want. So, for example, in Syria, the local Muslims would say, well, yeah, we're Sunni, but that's not how we do things here. We're very different from you. And they went ahead and ignored that, and they're trying to do things their way. And what's happening is that they're able to hold a certain core area, and then they're pushing out to areas where there's either no Syrian army presence and no rebel presence. And they're holding their own for now, the way they advertise on the internet. They advertise the way the young people who would like to reach them would see advertising. So Twitter, Facebook, videos, obviously. I know they get a lot of praise for their production values. I'm not real impressed with their production values, but they've been fairly successful primarily in Europe. There was something that came out yesterday that said that there are more British Muslim fighters in Syria and Iraq than in Great Britain.
You had an article, co-wrote an article for the Yale Center for the Study of Globalization called How to Turn Off the ISIS Tap. Spoiler alert, I'm going to go to the end of the article and read this to you, but the Islamic State may appear robust, but external fiscal flow and internal revenue generation can be halted quickly, leaving it with few resources for capturing Baghdad and Damascus, let alone sustaining a caliphate of nearly a million people. Explain how that could be done relatively quickly.
What the U.S. did is to bomb their oil facilities. And you don't need to bomb the oil wellhead, just the pipeline or the pumping station. So they bombed a lot of pumping stations. And then there were a lot of very small backyard or portable refineries. And so they bombed those refineries as well. So you could get it, you might be able to get it out of the ground, but transporting it would be very difficult. So they were able to do that, and then they were also able to work with Turkey and the Kurds in particular to shut down the smuggling that had been going on in the region. The Kurds, you know, they're sort of the heroes in a lot of the stories, but the Kurds had a notorious drug and cigarette and human trafficking and weapon smuggling in the eastern part of Turkey. And so they shut this down. They also shut down the smuggling of fuel into Turkey, but then also into Iran and Iraq. So that shut down one of their major flows. Another major flow has been kidnappings, primarily of foreigners. And foreigners have simply stopped going to the area quite so much. There are fewer and fewer reporters who've gone into the area, into ISIS areas. So there's less extortion to be made by kidnapping. In addition, the money that they got from taking over the bank in Mosul, a lot of that has been spent just on food and fixing the roads, electricity, things like that. So oil was the biggest one, then and then money for kidnapping, smuggling, and then, of course, their own reserves, which have significantly been spent down. The other major funding was from Gulf states who would give them both money and weapons, and the U.S. convinced them to shut that off as much as possible. And that wasn't necessarily just going to people and saying stop giving them money, as helping them to change some of their banking and financial regulations, which has helped a great deal as well.
So has all of that left ISIS in a weaker state than they were perhaps in the summer of 2014?
Financially, yes. They are much weaker. They are still capturing weapons and arms, primarily in Syria. They are capturing fewer arms in Iraq, particularly as the Iraqi security forces gain some discipline and some strength. And the American bombing has certainly helped. But we're seeing them capture anti-tank weapons, large caliber machine guns, different types of mortars and so on. So they're not capturing as many Humvees and Abrams tanks, but they're definitely in worse shape than they were.
So what would be the next step if the finances have been dealt with in a way that leaves them a little weaker? What would be the next thing that the U.S. and other nations might look at if they're trying to contain ISIS and, of course, ultimately defeat them and not have them spreading terror in the region?
Well, that's where you have to separate Syria and Iraq. The problems in Iraq had to do in part with the fall of Saddam Hussein. And this is disenfranchisement of anyone who had been a Ba'ath Party member. I mean, that's like telling somebody who'd had a good job for 20 years, you know, you're out of a job and you will never be employed again. So those people joined up with al-Qaeda in Iraq and then the Islamic State of Iraq. And that's one of the reasons they are such a disciplined force. But they then became, once the United States pulled out, Prime Minister al-Maliki was then not sharing money and not sharing jobs and things like that with other Sunnis. So there were Sunni protests from 2002 up to 2014. And that's why the comparison with the Taliban is very good, because you have to negotiate with those people. You have to talk to them and say, okay, what is it you want? I mean, we're not going to give you an Islamic State, but what is it you want? You're not going to talk to al-Baghdadi because he's not going to negotiate with you. But there are a lot of other people who were Ba'ath Party members who simply need to have some words with them. In Syria, it's a different story. Syria, Assad, is backed by Iran and by Russia. We have not gone in there because to go in there would mean to start a war with Iran and Russia. We are not interested in that, in having another proxy war. The problem there is that Assad clearly needs to feel the knife at his throat for anything to happen. And then what he will do at that point, he's demonstrated that he is the only time he'll negotiate is when he can win and you will lose. So that's the point at which maybe Iran will say, you know, look, Mr. Assad, we're going to move you to Latakia over on the coast, and you can have this little rump state here. Russia, you can have your Mediterranean base. Iran can have their foothold on the Mediterranean. But the rest of Syria, I'm sorry, we're going to need to create some kind of a nation out of this. A lot of the rebels, when Jabhat al-Nusra was there and not ISIS, they were asked, well, you know, these are al-Qaeda people and they're not necessarily doing what you want. A lot of the rebel commanders said, look, we have to defeat Assad first and then we'll deal with al-Qaeda. I think many of them are still of the same mind that they have to defeat Assad first, and then they will deal with al-Qaeda, and then they will deal with the Islamic State. And once that is settled, then there will be some kind of solution with the eastern part of Syria. But a lot of the problems in the area, 2007, 2008, there was a horrible drought. We keep forgetting how long the worldwide economic recovery is taking. These people have suffered horribly economically. And their economic situation, both in northern Iraq and in eastern Syria, northern Syria, has not improved. It's obviously gotten worse, certainly with more warfare. It's getting worse. So once that's settled, it's not just a matter of creating a polity. It's a matter of creating a working economy. Iraq has oil, so they have some solutions there they can turn to fairly quickly. Syria has a little bit of oil and gas, but they don't have a whole lot else in terms of an economy. They can't go back to the socialism that they had before. They're going to have to deal with a much more open society economically. And then socially, you know, that's up to the people to decide. But it isn't going to be easy to do. It's going to be a long haul, but it's also, in both instances, the solution has to be local. With bombing, we can certainly hold the line along the Kurdish areas of Syria and Iraq, but we're not holding them in the Sunni areas. They are advancing there.
Carol Choksi, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Carol Choksi will be part of a panel discussion at Western Michigan University on Friday, The Islamic State, Its Origins, Aims, and Capabilities. It begins at 3 o'clock at the Bernhard Center.